became legalized in 2016. That's the basic pain and suffering near end of life. Then there's track two made. That's the one that became legal in 2021. That's when the person is not necessarily at the end of their life. Now, what's supposed to happen in 2027, Canada is set to implement made for people who are suffering only with mental health issues. Now, this was already technically legalized in 2021, but its implementation was delayed in order to sort out logistical and ethical issues. And separately, Quebec has legislation that forbids this entirely. This idea of made for mental health issues only, this is where it gets really complicated for a lot of people, including Carrie Bowman.
That one is very, very tough, because the thinking would be that, you know, to say that the kind of suffering that comes with an aggressive malignancy, like meaning an aggressive cancer, that reaches the threshold where you're allowed to have medical assistance in dying. But the kind of suffering that comes from a long-term mental health disorder that has never responded to treatment, that's not acceptable. It's very tough. But here's the thing with mental health disorders is people that are living with significant mental health disorders, and the numbers are staggering, like over 70% are not employed. Their unemployment has nothing to do with attitude or laziness or anything. They're not well enough to hold down a job. I mean, you know, full-time jobs are tough enough for any of us, but people with, you know, full-blown mental health disorders, it's next to impossible. And because of that, unless they're from families with deep pockets or they have some kind of inherent safety net, they're incredibly vulnerable with housing and food security. And waiting lists for mental health support can be quite extensive. So, you know, one of the things that we're seeing, not just mental health disorders, but within a large domain, is that is the primary driver something like a social determinant of health? If a person actually had housing and they had food security, would they say, well, okay, I'm okay to carry on, even though I'm not very well, I'm okay to continue on. But when these things become compound and the person's living with, let's say, pain, illness, and the threat of losing housing, or they've already lost housing, or food security, or any of those things, that could tip the person to the point where they're asking for medical assistance and dying because of a social determinant of health. So the obvious solution is, well, we need to reweave the safety net and help people. There doesn't seem to be much appetite for that. I mean, there's a lot of national and international problems now, and they're receiving most of the attention. The economy, we don't know what's going to happen. So it's really, really tough. So, you know, build up the safety net. That's what I would like to see. And I still think we can do it. I think that's the right way to go. Others would say, well, just assess. And if you see that, you know, a good healthcare worker and a good social worker or something, you can assess. And when you see that their request is potentially being driven by what many would call social determinants of health and they're not eligible, well, you can't do that ethically, because that means someone in Rosedale is always eligible and someone who struggles financially is never, because you've got another injustice, right? So you can't really ethically justify that. So some people say, you know, just exclude everybody that has vulnerability. Well, it's nowhere near fair.
So mental health was the first of three dilemmas Carrie sees on the horizon. Here's the second.
The second one is advanced directives. So advanced directives, living will. So what's an advanced directive? If I or someone was diagnosed with early dementia, that if I were to say that I can live with this for now, but the day I can't recognize my own family, I want you to give me medical assistance in dying. Right now, that's not legal. So a lot of people think, well, that makes perfect sense. But when you look at how that would play out, so let's imagine in 2 years from now, you know, this person's, his daughters walk in on a Monday and he says, I don't know who you are. And they come in on a Tuesday and he says, I really have no idea who you are. Do you really think the nurses are going to take this confused patient into a small room on a Wednesday and give them medical assistance in dying? The reality of dementia is if you waited by the Friday, that person might say,
How are you? How are the kids? I mean, you know, like, because it comes and goes, right? So it's actually very, very tricky. And from a very philosophical point of view, the argument is you could be a stranger making decisions for a stranger. So for me to predict the kind of person I am and what I would want in a state of dementia is somewhat hypothetical. I could be agitated and unhappy. I could be more blissful than I've ever been in my life. Who knows? Agitated and unhappy is not rare, by the way, but there are some that go the opposite direction. So, you know, this is why it's very powerful. But Quebec is already allowing some form of advanced directives, and it looks like it will be allowed. It's very risky.
The third dilemma is age of consent.
So the other one would be age of consent. So there's no age of healthcare consent in most of the Canadian provinces. So you go, does the patient before you, whether they're 102 or 15, do they understand and appreciate? But with medical assistance in dying, by law, you have to be over 18. So a lot of people would say, well, that just makes good sense. But I can tell you two cases I saw. One of teenager that was 17 and 5 months, and he had an aggressive osteosarcoma, which is a horrible, like the cancer that Terry Fox had with all the amputations, and it was out of control, and he was heading towards death. And, you know, 17-year-olds being amputated extensively is off for anybody. He was, with the full support of his parents, he was absolutely not allowed medical assistance in dying because he was under 18. So less than a year later, we had a case of an 18-year-old, 18 and 3 months, with a very similar diagnosis, and she absolutely was allowed medical assistance in dying. So, you know, from an ethical point of view, you've got two people that are less than a year apart in age that have radically different choices. So that becomes an ethical challenge as well. So, I mean, one of the, probably the next legislative expansion will be the concept of a mature minor, depending on the nature of the young person. It's going to be very complicated. If I go back to the beginning of it, which was 2016, my perspectives have changed. I had some concern in 2016 as to how we were going to deal with the social complexity of this. Those concerns have greatly, greatly deepened, is number one, in which the collective we did not take the social determinants of health seriously enough, and we felt that we could, you know, we were skilled enough to recognize it. But recognizing it is not dealing with it. I'm beginning to see this as a culture shift. I see something much deeper because I've also worked a lot in the area of genetics and neonatology and the beginning of life and the end of life. I've worked both sides. And so what I'm seeing is more of a movement towards what types of lives are worth living. And I think that's actually a huge social transition, and that's not getting enough attention. And when the system, the government, the state, they don't overtly say it, and I've said this before, but when the system acknowledges that some types of human lives are not worth living, it's quite a statement to make, and I think you're going down a very risky path in a lot of ways. And I'm seeing it at the beginning of life, and I'm seeing it at the end of life, and I don't think it's receiving nearly enough attention. I think we're actually quite caught in the weeds over consent and this and that, and the big picture, I think, is something that's not getting enough attention. I can't imagine in Canadian society any of this being reversed. There's no political party seems to want to do that, but I think we will live with it. I think the continued expansions are going to be profoundly controversial, and I think it's going to be a very complex aspect of Canadian society for our entire lives, probably without full consensus ever.
That's your Canada Land episode. If you want to email me about it, please do. I'm at jesse@canadaland.com, and I read the emails that you send. This episode was reported by Julian Abraham. Our senior producer is Bruce Thorson. Audio production and editing from Caleb Thompson. Today's episode was fact-checked by Lucie Lemonnier. Our director of audio at Canada Land is Max Collins. I am the editor and publisher of Canada Land. Our theme music is by So-Called. Syndication is handled by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. You can visit them online at cfuv.ca. Hi there. You just heard Canada Land, the show where I'm typically joined by a different guest each week for a long feature interview. What you're going to hear next is Canada Land Shortcuts, a topical news show where I'm joined by a different co-host each week, and we talk about the media's coverage of various stories in the news right now. Wait for it. Quick note that the following episode of Canada Land may contain subject matter and language that some people will find offensive.
I'm Noor Azriyeh, and today we're talking about the news. We'll update you on Canada's Palestine position. It's changed. Kinda. But mostly, we'll talk about the Hockey Canada case and the media's unwillingness to reckon with our national sport.
We need to be asking the questions. Like, why was it so normal for these hockey players to do this? Why were they so practiced at it? How did they end up in that room? What sort of culture enables so many young men to be there?
Wait for that. Today we've got a pretty in-depth conversation about the Hockey Canada verdict with Archie Mann. But before we get into that, first things first. We've got an update for you on what's happening with Canada's position on Palestine. Archie and I talked about this in detail on Wednesday, but the story is evolving. On Wednesday, Mark Carney, standing side by side with his foreign minister Anita Anand, announced that the Canadian government is planning to recognize the state of Palestine.
Canada intends to recognize the state of Palestine at the 80th session of the United Nations General Assembly in September 2025.
The recognition will be contingent on a bunch of successful reforms by the Palestinian Authority, which doesn't govern Gaza, but governs the occupied West Bank.
This intention is predicated on the Palestinian Authority's commitment to much-needed reforms, including commitments by the Palestinian Authority's President Abbas to fundamentally reform its governance, to hold general elections in 2026 in which Hamas can play no part, and to demilitarize the Palestinian state. Canada will increase its efforts in supporting strong democratic governance in Palestine and the contributions of its people to a more peaceful and hopeful future. Canada reiterates that Hamas must immediately release all hostages taken in the horrific terrorist attack of October 7th, that Hamas must disarm, and that Hamas must play no role in the future.
The Canadian government statement comes after increasing international pressure to achieve a two-state solution. Canada's following in the footsteps of France's Emmanuel Macron and UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer. Shortly after this was announced, Donald Trump posted on Truth Social with, quote, "Wow, Canada has just announced that it is backing statehood for Palestine. That will make it very hard for us to make a trade deal with them. Oh, Canada." End quote. Keep in mind that the deadline for a possible Canada-US trade agreement is slash was supposed to be today, August 1st. And I'm sure we'll see a lot of discussion about Donald Trump's statements that our foreign policy decisions somehow have a relationship with our trade relations. We're going to see a lot of takes in the next few days kind of trickle in. The Globe and Mail put out a piece. Here's the headline. Canada's plan to recognize Palestinian statehood prompts swift, divided reaction. I am sure we are going to be seeing a divided reaction over the government's decision to recognize a Palestinian state. I mean, I'm seeing right now in the National Post by John Iveson, here's the headline, "Carney's Palestinian recognition emboldens terror, not peace." a recognition of a Palestinian state would vindicate Hamas's strategy that jihad, violence, and blood sacrifice is how you get what you want. What I would like to say to that is that not all Palestinians are Hamas, and recognizing people's right to self-determination and a state is not necessarily a reward for Hamas's terrorist attacks on October 7th. I do want to mention that the recognition of a Palestinian state does not end the war in Gaza. That is still ongoing. So in the context of everything that's going on the one hand, it's recognition of a Palestinian state that the country has never really done before. But on the other hand, the prospect of meeting those conditions seems close to impossible. And the Palestinian Authority has very little say over what goes on in Gaza. So it's not quite clear how many of these contingencies will actually be successful. And if they are not, what does that mean about Canada's commitment to recognizing a Palestinian state? Arshi Mann, co-founder of The Hatchet, former colleague on Canada Land's Commons podcast, and award-winning journalist for the sports documentary Commons Hockey. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Noor.
Before we get into this, I just want to note that today's episode deals with sexual assault and hazing, and some of the details are pretty graphic. Listen, Arshi, you know this, but I will admit it again. I don't really care too much about the game of hockey.
I don't know, Noor. When we went to go see the Barrie Colts play, you seemed to care a lot about the game of hockey.
I was excited about the, what are they called? The what are they called?
The
ice. No.
The Zambonis.
Zambonis.
Yes, that's
what they're
right.
Called. Like, that's what excited me.
Yes, like a child. I understand.
Correct. I've been to like 2 games ever. Yeah. Anyways, we did a full season on hockey and the troubling culture of the sport in Canada. And for that reason, I've been following this Hockey Canada trial quite closely. And we finally got a verdict last week.
Let's begin with the acquittal of those 5 former world junior hockey players of sexual assault.
Obviously, a story that has been at the forefront of the Canadian sports scene for years now.
I have seen these types of stories time and time again.
At issue here was whether the sexual activity that occurred in that hotel room that night was consensual or not.
When it relates to things like sexual assault, that burden of evidence becomes really difficult.
I will say, if you compare this to the Monica Lewinsky case, you know, we've come a long way.
What I was seeing online yesterday were a lot of people sharing the concern that, will this verdict mean that there'll be a return to this idea of kind of like hockey culture's fine, or there's no need for changes.
So for those of you who haven't been following the story, this was a trial where a complainant named E.M. alleged that she was sexually assaulted by 5 former world junior hockey players in a hotel room in 2018. The trial has been all over the news, often in extremely graphic detail. E.M. was on the stand for about 9 days. It started out as a jury trial, then the jury was dismissed, and then there was another jury trial, and that was dismissed, and it seemed to go on forever. And last week, the verdict came in. Not guilty on all counts. I'm not really in a position to evaluate the legal decision. I'm not a lawyer, but I do want to talk about the media coverage of the verdict. While the trial was happening, Laura Robinson, who has been on the show before, she's an incredible sports journalist. She's been covering sexual assault in hockey forever. And my sense from hearing that discussion, as well as the reporting that we've done on Commons, was that no matter what the verdict in the trial ended up being, there are a lot of problems with what happened in the hotel room and with hockey culture writ large in this country. Arshi, I noticed a ton of productive discussions around consent, the larger issues in our legal system when it comes to cases involving trauma and sexual assault. But I haven't seen a lot of coverage about the culture of hockey itself and the reckoning with that culture. There are some pieces from The Athletic, The New York Times, Sports Magazine. The Hockey Canada trial could have been a reckoning. It was something else. Or from The Line, what changed at Hockey Canada? But there hasn't been that larger discussion in the media. Why do you think that hasn't been as big of a part of the conversation right now?
I think one of the reasons why the conversation remains static and stagnant is because it's uncomfortable to talk about what's actually happening in hockey culture, especially around specific kinds of sexual practices. The truth is that over and over, every few years, there are serious allegations of gang rape that's alleged to have been committed by hockey players. And those are just not words anybody wants to say.
I was just going to say, no one really uses that kind of language so explicitly as you have.
Yeah, and if you listen to our hockey series on Commons that we did a few years back, we make a very explicit point of this, and specifically Laura Robinson, who you just mentioned, talks about this quite a bit. It's not just about consent more broadly. It is not just about sexual assault. It's about a very specific form of sexual practices that often crosses the line over into rape or other kinds of assault.
A gentleman in Saskatchewan just happened to tell me in 1992 about, he alleged that a girl had been gang raped by members of the Swift Current Broncos and that the guys got away with it. And what happened to the girl in Swift Current was extremely brutal. She bled for 3 days. For those guys to think that that would be consensual and for the community to think that she would consent to that, it's just appalling.
And nobody wants to talk about it because we don't want to explicitly acknowledge the reality that young hockey players like to have sex with each other, usually in the form of having a woman present as well. But it's oftentimes a number of hockey players and one or maybe two girls or women who are there. And until we acknowledge what's actually happening there and how this sort of sexual ritual that hockey players engage in is part of basically a spectrum of things that run all the way from sexualized hazing and into a form of almost sexualized team bonding. Until we acknowledge the realities of that and have uncomfortable conversations, I don't think much is going to change. And the thing is, the discomfort comes from a lot of different places. It's not just a kind of prudishness, but you also have people who will say we don't want to kink shame or something like that. But I'm sorry, this is not, I think, a healthy way to be, to have 17, 18, 19 year olds routinely, their first sexual experiences being in this kind of a group setting. And it, I think, ends up screwing up a lot of their ideas around what consent is and what's normal. And it is going to, even in the best case scenario, lead to just, I think, forms of sexual dysfunction. Mm-hmm. But in the worst forms, to really horrific events in which girls and women are abused. And I do just want to say here that I'm not trying to damn these players in particular or say that they should have gone to jail or that the verdict should have been guilty. We have a very high bar for criminal prosecution, for criminal conviction in this country, and I think that is a good thing. Mm-hmm. But just because there's a not guilty verdict in this case, it does not mean that there is not a pretty awful culture within hockey that leaves a lot of boys, young men, girls, and young women seriously messed up.
You know, we're living through this nationalist moment. We're literally calling this the elbows up moment, which is a hockey term.
Did you know it was a hockey term, Noor?
You know what? James did, in fact, tell me this. I did not know it was a hockey term. We're learning things about Canadian culture. But yeah, does that make it harder to reckon with things like hockey, which are a pillar of Canadian identity?
I've been wondering that the last few days, and I don't think in this specific instance, at least how the conversation around sexual misconduct in hockey has shifted during the course of this trial. I don't think we can attribute that to the kind of nationalist, pseudo-nationalist, I'll say, moment that we're in the midst of. I think what has been much more operative has been the kind of quote-unquote anti-woke backlash. We're in a very post-Me Too moment. I think there's a feeling that there were a lot of excesses that took place over the last few years that now need to be reined back in. Mm-hmm. This is always what happens. There's always a kind of backlash to moments of social progression. And frankly, there were a lot of excesses. Don't get me wrong. But I think a lot of people are frankly throwing the baby out with the bathwater. But this is always also what happens when you try to have complex cultural discussions that are centered on a legal judgment, right? The courts are not there to tell us what's right and what's wrong. They are there to tell us who should pay criminal consequences for their actions, as long as we can prove that it was beyond a reasonable doubt. And beyond a reasonable doubt is not a sufficient standard to have cultural change by. Otherwise, nothing would ever change.
Yep.
And so I think that is more what has been happening. But I will say that I do think you have a broader point in that hockey is difficult to change in general because it is so tied up in our own conceptions of ourselves.
That is our show for today. Thank you for joining me. You can email me about it at noor@canadaland.com. I read everything you send. You can also find me posting on Blue Sky at noorazriye.bluesky.whatever-the-hell-comes-after-that. Archie, man, where can people find you and your work?
They can find us at The Hatchet on Substack, or if you go to your browser, you can type in hatchetmedia.substack.com, or in your favorite podcast app, just look up The Hatchet. We're doing podcasts, we're doing newsletters, and we have a lot of really exciting investigations that are coming up that you won't want to miss, about stories that, frankly, you will, I think, find almost unbelievable if, unfortunately, they weren't true.
Check it out, The Hatchet. This episode is produced by James Nicholson. The associate producer is Lucy Lemonnier, who also did the fact-checking. Mixing and mastering is by Tristan Capicchione. Our director of audio is Max Collins. The editor and publisher of Canada Land, it's Jesse Brown. Theme music is by So Called. Syndication is by CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria. Visit them online at cfuv.ca.
This is Bird Note. With silver, gold, and copper-toned plumage, Gamble's quail have every reason to strut their stuff on the trails of the Sonoran Desert. But their fancy headdress would fit right in at the Met Gala. Both males and females look like they've got a large, inky black comma poised atop the crown of their heads. Their grassland relatives, the California quail, have them too. For both species, this decorative topknot is formed from six individual feathers that contour together into a single structure that appears to bounce lightly with each step. And these are hardly the only quail with a fancy updo. In the Sierra Nevada and Cascade Mountains, the mountain quail displays two long and wispy black head plumes that stick straight up when the bird is alert. In the deserts of northwestern Mexico, the elegant quail sports a shock of coppery feathers like a fire atop the bird's head. Scaled quail, named for the almost reptilian pattern of their breast feathers, don't have a topknot per se, But they do have a modest crest with a flash of white, earning them the nickname Cotton Tops. It's hard to say why each of these species evolved such elaborate head feathers. Perhaps they help quail attract a mate and intimidate other suitors. But whatever the intended purpose, these birds are ready for even the fanciest functions. For Bird Note, I'm Ariana Rimmel.